Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning. Steve Williamson here. Mike Cosentino will be sitting across from me in a moment. He fled the room. I don't know why.
I'm here.
Today we have one of the Internet's most well-known ones, most successful bloggers, Digby.
On a second time, we might add.
Yeah, on our second show. Her name's Heather Parton. As we mentioned before, people were surprised when they saw her arrive and get an award, because they assumed that she was male, and she's not. But she gets something like 166,000 hits on her website a week. So Mike, you had some young people ask you some questions to ask Heather. Heather, you're there?
Oh, yeah,
she's not there.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Yeah. One of the things they said while we're waiting for Heather is that Digby sounded like a sports guy. You know.
Yeah.
She has a collection of left leaning links. Some of the best I've seen. A very good collection of links on her website, Hullabaloo. And so, yeah, we want to talk about that. I was sitting with a group of activists, which may be too strong a word. These are young people that are trying to make a living, yet try to have some social consciousness at the same time. And wanted to talk to somebody that has been successful at it, and see how she keeps up her motivation to keep going.
She's one of the great writers on the internet, or collectors of information. I haven't seen anybody who can edit better than she can. She'd take a segment from right-wing, left-wing stuff and just and illuminate it. Are you there?
I'm here. I'm sorry. I dropped out a couple of times. So.
Yeah, that happens. Not to worry. Mike was just saying that he would talk to some young people, and they wanted to know, before we talk about politics, about blogging. And they're very frustrated with their blogs, right, Mike?
Frustrated with blogs, frustrated with getting out any message. It's hard to maintain motivation, because in their case, they're trying to, well, kind of like you have other people on your blog, and just keep things going. How do you do that?
Well, that's probably the hardest part, to be honest with you. I mean, I work 7 days a week, and I write every single day, and you've kind of, you have to feed the baby. It's an absolute necessity to be very, very diligent about writing a lot and keeping up with what's going on. Having said that, I'm sympathetic to people trying to start in this environment. It was a lot easier when I started, which was almost 10 years ago. It was a very small little community. Of course, nobody was reading us either.
So, yeah, but lots of people read
but we
you
did,
now.
So, there was a slow build, and I'm kind of grandfathered in or grandmothered in at this point. But for someone starting off today who wants to be a writer or a blogger in the sort of traditional sense, and it sounds funny to say there's a traditional sense, but there is. It's hard to to do it, but the best thing to do is to write a lot and try and be part of various communities that are talking about the things that you're interested in and share your work with them, which means you've got to be, active in comment sections, you've got to be active in forums, you have to sort of dedicate yourself to getting it, crashing through all the white noise that's out there, and getting people who are interested in what you're interested in aware of what you're doing. And, they're always, it's very, very difficult. It's there are millions of blogs out there. But people do break through. I mean, it happens. it's like any other thing. You know, it's like, I don't, you know, you want to be a musician or something. If you write well and you have some luck and you are diligent about trying to get people to hear you, people do break through. Every year there's new people who come along who are doing it and who are, you know, making a difference. So
very good. I will pass that on. And just so you know, this is Downtown Phoenix, a group of artists, people that have had, and that's part of the reason they had some success in art, they, at least in their community, they've had some success in other endeavors, and yet this one thing in the opinion endeavor, and they are very good at setting up communities, trading communities and supportive communities, and yet this is the one thing that has stymied them and frustrated them. But I will hopefully they're listening, and they got it directly from
We do recommend everyone go to Digby's blog.
Yes.
and see, she's extraordinarily productive. She reads very widely,
conservative, click on all the ad banners.
liberal sources. She has some advertising on there, so go click on those ads, guys.
That's right.
Yeah. That's right.
That helps a blogger keep going, too. We wanted to talk today, really, about the politics of deficit reduction. And we've had Jamie Galbraith, an economist, on, and we've had Dean Baker, and we talked about the core of the issues. How did deficit reduction become the prime way of dealing with the current deep, deep recession when the traditional economic thing is to use both stimulus and raising taxes to get out of a recession? In other words, if you don't have a job, one way you can do is cut your expenses. The other thing you can do is go out and make more money and get the whole system going.
That's what I always did on a personal level.
Well, you know, it's an excellent question, and it's one that people don't ask enough. I know it stymied some of the economists, people like Baker and Galbraith, who were sitting going, how did this happen? You know, where did we had this figured out, and yet somehow or another we hit this recession and did the opposite of what everybody knew you were supposed to do in a recession. And, America, we did a little bit. We did some stimulus, but we offset it with a bunch of cuts at the same time, which meant that whatever stimulus we had was, you know, much less effective than it would have been. It was inadequate. It was not enough. We knew at the time it happened that there was going to be no going back because the politics were such that it was, you know, nearly impossible to even get any stimulus at all. So, you know, this is a very weird situation, and I think that historians are going to look back on this and put together some kind of a thesis on how we got to this point. I would just say that this is the result of several decades of right-wing propaganda about deficits, which, you know, this crops up over and over and over again. You know, deficit reduction, deficits, they're, you know, the future, they're killing us, our children, you know, going on and on and on. And I remember I quoted recently Bob Kerry. I mean, this is bipartisan, by the way. It isn't just Republicans, but they are the sort of source of the propaganda. The Democrats have simply adopted it as the, I think it's just the easier way to get through. Maybe some of them even believe it. I don't know. But Bob Kerry back in the 90s, you know, he was saying that the Social Security was going to consume the entire budget of America by 2012. He said this absolutely. This is going to happen. We have to cut Social Security now because it's going to consume America's entire budget in 2012. Well, I mean, you know, not exactly the greatest predictor in the world. But this is the kind of thing that deficit hawks have been saying for decades now. So,
well, John Boehner's getting ready to hold the whole country hostage again because of the deficit.
Yes.
The Speaker of the House, Boehner.
Yes. And, you know, I don't know what's going to happen here. It's a very, very disturbing sign that we've got, you know, Nancy Pelosi, for instance, kind of coming out and saying, well, I would have voted for Simpson-Bowles. If it had been the original Simpson-Bowles, I would have voted for it. Now, that's a big change from the time, you know, Simpson-Bowles was originally presented.
Could you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, sorry.
That's
Simpson-Bowles
right.
was the Deficit Reduction Commission put together by President Obama.
Uh-huh.
And they never were able to, you know, come up with a final report because they couldn't get an agreement among the commission.
Right.
The right-wingers said it didn't go far enough in deficit reduction. The left-wingers said it was, you know, it went too far, and so they ended up without being able to get a consensus. But the two chairs, Alan Simpson, a famed Republican, retired Republican senator, and Erskine Bowles, who is a longtime Democratic insider from North Carolina, they were the two co-chairs, and they submitted their own personal report on what needed to be done. And in a great sleight of hand, that has simply become Simpson-Bowles, which, you know, there was no consensus. Nobody ever wanted it. Everybody hated it at the time. But now it's kind of become the baseline that everybody's sort of accepting as the consensus starting point for negotiations, which is really sad because it is very extreme.
It's flawed.
Why is it that it's always Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid? It looks like Paul Ryan in his recent budget pivoted a little bit, went on after Medicare and Social Security, which he had kind of kept off the table, and went after Medicaid. He went after all the programs that support folks who are in bad shape, elderly and disabled, and people who really have almost no money at all.
Those programs that created the middle class. I love that term that I believe Jamie Galbraith used. These programs not only help the middle class, they create the middle class by you don't have to put out your life savings for health care at the end of your life and so on.
So people start out without any money and you take what little money they've got away. What are they going to buy? Isn't that going to deepen the recession?
Well, yeah. but
we're very
you know, we're
into pointing out the obvious.
We're dealing with kind of a bizarro world version of what's going on, which is that the safety net programs are the cause of the recession, when in fact many of them, Medicaid and some of the other ones, you know, even things like food stamps or unemployment insurance, they're not the cause, they're the result of the recession. And so, you know, we've got people operating from, you know, kind of two different interpretations of reality. It's very, very difficult. I mean, people talk a lot about this polarization, and it's very real. And it's real not just in the sense, it's not just political positioning. This is a very real difference of opinion about how the world works, how the economy works, how it should work.
But let's talk about reality for a minute. I go down to my local pizza place here in Sedona, or I go to a nice restaurant, and either one, and actually, and it could be one and the same. Now, but I look around and I see people on Lockheed.
He considers the pizza places a fancy restaurant.
Top drawer, absolutely. But I see people who are on Lockheed Martin pensions. I see people who are on government pensions. I see retired military. These are the people that have the money that are driving this economy, and whose friends are coming to visit them and staying in the hotels and going on the hiking trails. You know, it's a boomer economy here because they have a pension and hopefully they're able to combine a little bit of Social Security with that pension and have disposable income. I don't get it. The reality is without them, the economy is even worse than it is.
Well, I think that the idea behind the conservative approach to this is that, well, we're not going to do it now. What we need to do is cut Social Security and by the way, government pensions. I mean,
that's
I think
right.
Those are going to be on the chopping block, too, not to mention veterans benefits. I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff out there that people depend on that are part of their, you know, their earned benefits over a lifetime of work. And, you know, they're talking about, well, we're not going to cut it right now. We're going to cut it in the future so that our kids won't have to bear the burden of this. Now, I mean, that's a real bait and switch because the fact is that, you know, somebody's going to pay for elderly people to live one way or the other, right? I mean, unless we adopt the attitude that we're going to put them on an ice floe.
With global warming, there'll be more ice flows.
Yeah, exactly. That's assuming that there would be any ice flows to put them on. I guess maybe we could do a Viking thing and put them in a, you know, in a boat. And
we can't do much associated with water. We set them out in the desert. And
there you go. Send them walking out in the desert with a, you know, a small bottle of water.
A plastic bottle of water.
See how you do. But in any case, unless we adopt that as our official policy, you know, the elderly have got to be cared for. They can't work. They're sick. They have this. So it just depends on, you know, who's going to pay for it, how much suffering they will have to do. And, you know, the idea is that we're going to do that tomorrow. Don't worry, you seniors down there in Sedona, you know, eating your fancy pizza. We're not going to do it to you.
That's right.
We're just going to do it to somebody down the road. But we have to do it because we need to do it for your kids. The interesting thing is most seniors see through that. Absolutely.
Yes.
They know that that's a nonsensical concept. And they want their kids to have what they have. And feel that they deserve it. they don't want to take that away. So, you know, there has to be some kind of reckoning between these two disparate worldviews.
Is there a voter tsunami out there waiting to vote against these thoughts? Or are they able to keep those policies obfuscated enough that when they get into the voting booth or they send in that card, that's not primary motivator for them to check the D or the R boxes?
Well, you know, in the past it has been. I mean, people have messed with the senior programs to their regret in the past.
In the past.
It has not been something, you know, I can't remember what it was 86 or something, where they did some change in some of the Social Security rules, and there was a huge rebellion among people over 65, and they actually reversed it because it was such a you know, they had a bunch of gray panthers out there, you know, trying to knock over cars. So, I mean, it was definitely it was quite the rebellion. They learned very quickly this was not a constituency they wanted to mess with, at least not in their own time, right?
Right.
So they learned that lesson.
It's always going to happen to somebody else, and that's the way they claim the changes in Medicare stuff. And the new talk is it's going to happen to really, really poor people, not regular people on
like,
Medicare.
Like us.
And they deserve it. In fact, there's this really interesting right-wing view that the poor people aren't contributing enough, and therefore they deserve it. You know, remember when Michelle Bachmann was running, she kept going on and on about how, you know, they need to pay something, even if it's just a Happy Meal. And there was, you know, there's this idea that it's called the 47% that, you know, don't pay federal income tax. Of course, they pay all the other taxes. But because they're so poor, you know, they're working, obviously.
Right.
Or they wouldn't be paying taxes, you know, or wouldn't be, you know, even on the books that way. But they're poor. They're working poor people who there is this, you know, kind of concerted effort to build resentment toward them, that they're not contributing enough to society, and so they don't deserve to have all these.
We cut federal taxes on people who really don't have much income because they really don't have much income.
Exactly. They just don't have the money. And by the way, they are paying in to the, you know, so-called entitlements. They pay Social Security. No, everybody pays that.
Right.
Pays into Social Security and Medicare. They pay sales taxes. They pay state taxes. You know, they pay taxes. But it's just the federal income tax. And the idea was to give them a little bit of a lift to help these people out of poverty so that they could have enough money to maybe buy something, which helps the economy, which maybe they could afford to go to college or do something else, that, you know, you would give them a little bit of a chance to work their way out of poverty. But that's become a very unpopular thing among certain sort of right-wing intellectual types who are trying to create, you know, just don't call it class war, though, right, because that would be wrong. So, you know, getting back to the deficit thing, I mean, look, this is a concerted effort on the part of conservatives, and this goes all the way back to the beginning of the New Deal, really, But
they've never accepted Social Security and Medicare.
Did.
They're quiet for long periods of time. We were talking earlier, and you said that basically a lot of the opposition, a lot of the things that the people are getting everyone fired up and really afraid is coming from basically the same sort of billionaire contributors who are trying to make sure that there's no increase in taxes on the
1%. That's right. I mean, this is, and there's also, you know, there's just an actual ideological, philosophical commitment on the part of some of these vastly wealthy people to ending what they consider to be, you know, a socialistic, you know, government program.
For that reason only, no matter how much good it does. And
right. That's irrelevant to them.
Yeah.
They're ideologically opposed to it. I mean, specifically, I'm talking about Pete Peterson, who is a very, very, very successful, you know, Wall Street financier, has been for decades, founded a group called the Blackstone Group. He's a multi-billionaire, and he, in the last decade or so, he's been agitating against Social Security since the 70s, by the way. He was in the Nixon administration in some role as Assistant Commerce Secretary or something. But he's been agitating against Social Security for decades, and In recent years, as he's gotten more and more wealthy, he has funded an institute called the Pete Peterson Institute, which is devoted to what they call deficit reduction, but what is really, you know, and is clearly designed to end Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, all the what they term to be socialistic enterprises. Now, it's a very bipartisan undertaking. In fact, they just had a big meeting. They do it annually. And they had Bill Clinton there, who was saying, yes, we've really got to deal with entitlements. And they had, you know, they garner big names of both parties to agree.
Wait, you mean Bill Clinton, our last great Republican president?
Exactly.
Okay, go on.
Exactly, yes.
But
Mr., you know, end welfare as we know it. So,
yeah.
You know, of course. And he's there, you know, lending his prestige to that whole concept. When the truth is that Social Security is simply not in bad shape. It has a scheduled, you know, a projected shortfall, which now is based upon this horrible downturn that we're in, which hopefully we will be out of.
Yeah. Folks, understand that the projections for the end of Social Security change with the economic environment. If the economy improves, the problem is going to recede at an incredible rate. If it improves a lot, it's going to recede pretty much, you know, in the foreseeable future.
But go ahead with your stats. You got some stats there, Digby?
Well, no. I mean, I don't have any specific statistics except to say that, you know, until the recession, we were scheduled to have a potential shortfall in something like 2039.
Right.
Because of the current recession, it's now pulled back a couple of years.
Yeah, 2037.
Yeah. So, you know, this is how this goes. And these are projections. I mean, if people could project this that accurately, I think they should be on Wall Street, right?
why
aren't they all billionaires making these kinds of projections?
So, to a successful businessman, he said, you cannot project anything beyond 5 years. Nobody in business tries to do these 30-year projections of income and expenses and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the truth is that they are, you know, projections are very, very vague, and yet they're used as if they are, you know, came down from Mount Sinai
right.
to justify the idea that somehow or another Social Security has to be cut. But here's the most, you know, the most ironic piece of it, actually nonsensical. They say there's going to be a shortfall in 2037 or 2039. So, and it will only be able to pay out something like 80% of what is scheduled to be paid out. So we need to cut now so that it will be 100%, meaning that the 80%, we need to cut it now because it's going to be a shortfall later. I mean, there is absolutely no logic to this, and yet somehow or another that is passing through. You know, even some of the smartest people in the world are going, yeah, well, okay, we really do need to do this. It's ridiculous. And the Social Security exists outside the normal budgeting process. There's no reason for it to even be discussed in the context of deficit reduction.
Exactly. That's the point we continually try to make on this show. There's no relationship between the budget and Social Security, except for whatever rating is going on behind the scenes.
And I guess unpopular as it may be, I think both Mike and I agree that we need to strengthen Social Security. I mean, it's one of the things that works because you start paying in it when you're 20 years old and you can't even believe you're going to live to be 65. And it works because everybody pays into it.
Right.
And you pay a small amount of money your whole life. And I would not be averse to increasing payments because I think that what's happening is the whole pension system is collapsing for ordinary folks.
Right, exactly.
And so more and more people are dependent just on Social Security and some savings, help from relatives to get by.
Well, the fix that I've read is that you have at $50,000 a year, you're paying 6 or 8%, and $150,000, you're paying 1 or 2%.
Yeah.
If you're paying the same at $150,000 income, Social Security's fixed. Done. Next question.
Why can't employers pay 1% more than people who are working are putting in? Just 1%.
Read my lips.
That would solve the problem. In fact,
read
it could
her
increase Social Security. Have them put in one more percent. It's still not a lot of money if you start early and you do it consistently and everyone does it.
Well, that's what the beauty of the system, isn't it?
It is.
You know, that it, and you know, and look, Social Security, and we have to remember this, isn't just, you know, some nice middle class people having retiring at 65 and traveling the world. Social Security supports tons of people who are disabled and can't work. I mean, this is a program that any of us that could happen to. You know, we get in a car accident tomorrow, and we can't work anymore.
Oh, yeah, they are paying their emergency room bill with their Social Security. They are paying their grandkids' emergency room bill with their Social Security.
Yes.
So, yeah, no, it's you talk about it, and they're buying food for their daughter-in-law, who just had her third baby.
Yeah, I don't think folks in the Beltway, Republicans and some Democrats, really understand how important and how dependent people are on Social Security in the rest of the country.
No, I don't think so either. And, you know, look, there's another argument to be made here, which is that in order to have a dynamic society, you know, especially a dynamic economy, you have to have people have a little bit of, you know, ability to take risk. If you have, you know, if you're dealing in a world where there's, you know, your health care is precarious and extremely expensive, where there are no pensions, there's no Social Security, how are you going to start a business? How are you going to take any risk? It's just not going to happen. Everyone will hunker down and, you know, you'll be far less inclined to, you know, contribute to society in that way by being able to take a risk. You just can't have a dynamic society where everybody, you know, where you've got immigrants and, you know, young people and all kinds of new people coming into the system and able to create a new business or a new venture of some sort, where there's no fallback. I think it's a very, very short-sighted kind of proposition on the part of these billionaires. But of course, to them, you know, what difference does it make?
Well, the more money you have, the less important Social Security is to your retirement. It's that. The less you really need Medicare, if you have billions of bucks, you can pay for the best medical care right out of your pocket. Most people really can't do that, and most people don't have decent pensions anymore. And as you were saying earlier, one generation still has, some people still have them, but I think the current generation, it's benefits are minimal. We've got to go pretty soon. Tell us your URL for your blog, and we hope people will go and read Digby. She's one of the great writers on the internet.
She makes a hullabaloo.
Well, thanks very much. My URL is digbysblog.blogspot.com, or you can just go to Google and type in Digby, and I think I usually come up first or second or so.
You do. I just did it this morning.
so that's an easy way to, you know, just remember my name and Google it. And, you know, I hope that people do stop by. One, keep in mind that the politics of this are very much in flux. We're going to see what happens after this election on deficit reduction, but watch very carefully because there's a lot going on in Washington, and it's very obscure. We can't really see what's happening.
And you can catch this interview on vvid.org, as you can catch all our podcasts on that. Thank you.
Excellent. Next week, we have Paul Lins talking about Iran. The week after, we have Winona Benally Baldinegro, who's
That's
running
right.
for Congress. And then we have a program on the privatizations of prisons in Arizona. Been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.